Beverly Hills is a great friend of mine.
Mobiliano.
Arnaldo Mobiliano, professor of Roman history in London, who was one of the two, three best Roman historians living. A very, very great talent. He was a friend, because he was interested in typical Jewish, Italian Jewish intellectual, interested in lots of things, rather like Primo Levi, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
He said to somebody I knew, in any other university, Isaiah Berlin would have had followers, but in Oxford, none. Isn't it strange? It isn't strange, because it's one thing which I managed to get rid of, for both. Prevent with any kind of, I didn't have a doctrine, didn't have followers, didn't want to create a cenacle, didn't want to have a school.
Yes. But you have extremely devoted students, Charles Taylor.
He was never a student.
Well, I mean...
Friends, he was never a student.
Friends.
He was a Belial, he had nothing to do with him.
Ah, right.
No, I never taught him. Students, well, my students aren't always devoted to me, no. I think before the war I had no devoted students.
After the war?
One or two graduate students. Undergraduates. I became professor, you see. And then we had graduates after that.
When did you become professor, by the way?
56. 56. Or 7. Can't know which.
Annus Mirabilis, you get 57. Married, you're knighted.
57. That's Annus Mirabilis. Yeah. I got married in 56, I think.
Yeah.
I became professor in 57. I was made of a fellow at British Academy. I became a professor.
You're knighted?
No, knighted. Savior.
Tell me good.
Quite correct. Like Roy Jenkins, who said, you're getting an honorary degree at Yale? I said, yes. Oxford? Cambridge, Harvard, and Yale. Nobody has ever done that before. The last thing that occurred to me, I have to admit to. I do have too many honorary degrees. I have 20.
Yes.
Too many.
Too many.
What do I mean? Why?
Why are they giving them to you?
Well, exactly. I can give you...
What do they say the reasons are? You're a great figure.
My view is that usually there are candidates for it, and there are people who urge them. And there are usually two schools, for A and against A, for B and against B.
Right.
Then somebody mentions my name. Nobody is, I have very few enemies.
Yeah.
So they settle on me as a kind of compromise candidate. I'm a kind of, perhaps a professional compromise candidate. God knows, why should Cambridge give me a degree all those years ago? Quite early on. 15 years ago. What have they done?
Well, you've written some good books, that's why.
Not one. I read a book called Karl Marx, and then just a few essays. Shouldn't be imprinting. That's all I mean. I never read a proper book again. Not really. The book on Karl Marx was a primer. I'm not very
written. It's a more interesting book than that.
What?
It's a more interesting book than that.
Is there a more?
It is a more interesting book than
maybe
you say.
A little, maybe a little. But it's fundamentally a sort of pièce d'occasion. And I've told you, I've
no, what seems interesting to me about it, and very interesting psychologically, is that it's one of the most interesting examples I know of a book written by one temperament, namely your own, that inquires into another temperament, radically different.
And not friendly either.
And not friendly to it, and yet gives an account from the inside that seems to me very subtle and perceptive.
Well, let me tell you, the one thing about that book is nobody could make out what my own political views were from that book.
Yeah.
That's typical of me.
Yeah.
That's like not accepting responsibility.
Yeah.
To some extent, you see, I don't, I sit on the fence. I mean, I don't plump.
Yes.
I'm not a crusader. Last 10 years I've had views, strong kind, and not concealed them.
Mostly about Israel.
Yes, but about other things as well. About who? In the 30s I was anti-conservative, 100%. No, anti-appeasement, anti-Chamberlain, anti-Baldwin, no use for that at all. Yeah. I was a perfectly decent member of the Labour Party.
Yes. And in the 50s? In the late 40s and 50s?
Well, I left the Labour Party on the Palestine policy. Bevin.
Yes.
That's true. After that, there was no SDP. I was a Lib-Lab. Known as sort of
a Butskalite in some sense.
Mm, yes. Sort of liberal. Yes. Certain kind. But no strong views. Shocked by this, shocked by that. I never was a socialist. For reasons I tried to explain to myself. Partly because I didn't want to want management from the center. That is true, and that is genuine.
Because you were libertarianism.
Yes. And partly because, for more technical reasons, I thought that socialism meant, to some extent, an attempt at autarky. That's to say, self-control of our country. A country which controls its own economic destiny. And therefore not buffeted too much by things outside which it couldn't control.
Yes.
Russia and America could do that.
Yes.
Because they could live on their own resources. England never.
Yes.
Because exports and imports.
Yes.
The attempt to, as it were, control, to have total state control of industry or trade,
yeah,
couldn't succeed if there were storms from outside. Mm. Would make a difference. And that was absurd, even to try to create socialism in one country,
yeah,
in a country of that size, mm, and so dependent on imports. Mm. It's a simple view.
Do you remember yourself as being sympathetic to the post-war Attlee government, or was the Palestine question so overshadowed?
No, I was sympathetic. In general, yes. The welfare state I liked very much. I didn't know that Attlee was as anti-Zionist as he was, in fact. But it wasn't here, my declaration. No. This is a perfectly isolated thing. In general, I had absolutely no distaste for the Labour government. I didn't mind it a bit.
Did you keep up with Crossman when he went into politics?
No, I see him inevitably from time to time. Because we live in Oxford.
Yes.
Even then, you see. But no, I was never really a friend of his either. We were on quite familiar terms, but not exactly friendly.
Because you felt he was a bully?
Yes, and a
sort of flash Harry as well.
False in some way.
Why false?
Because he didn't really believe in anything very much. He was knocked down. Politically, what repelled me was he was a left-wing Nazi. The nearest to it, I can describe his politics as be. He was anti-capitalist, quite genuinely. Hated civil service. Hated respectability. Hated sort of conventional values of a sort of peaceful, honest, decent, dreary civil service. That was genuine. Mm. On the other hand, what he wanted was young men singing songs, hearty, welcome, sort of students with linked arms, drinking beer and singing songs, Kraftwerk Freude. I mean, so Nazi marches, Deutschland.
Mm.
Combination is exactly what is meant by left-wing Nazi. Mm. Strasser brothers.
Right.
That's Riddle, whom Hitler eliminated in June 30th. Shot them. Mm. That's what Crossman belonged to. Mm. And it is fundamentally strong fascist streak of wanting himself to dominate, like power, hated mildness, liberalism, kindness, amiability. It provoked him.
Right. You never confronted him with this?
Not really, no. No, I don't think I ever did. No. I remember a story she told me, which is highly typical. His father was a very respectable judge called Sir Stafford Crossman. He was a Chancellor Barrister, became a judge. He went to see him and said, "I'm going to get married." So Stafford said, "Oh, who?" "And she's German, first wife." "Oh, really? Well, what is that? Does she have a profession?" "Yes, she's a prostitute." It was an overstatement. The judge was taken aback rather. It's a Crossman story. Very square. He said, "But in that case, why do you want to marry her?" which Grossman struck the table with his fist and said, that's what members of your generation will never understand. It's because she's a prostitute that I've got to marry. So the Dostoevsky position. That's what I mean. I mean, he wanted to somehow blow up his father, do something violent, do something of that sort, let them tremble. And the great thing is to put sort of squibs under them.
Yes.
You see, make them blow up. That was the chief desire. He was highly destructive. Yeah. At the same time, he was a workerist, went to Winchester, very good brain, organizing ability. When he was subordinate of New College, and when Fisher had nervous breakdown, the warden, when he was a minister, government, extremely good departmental chief, very good at the actual business of organizing a college or a department, together with his ferocious, nihilistic streak.
Yeah.
That's what I didn't like. And then, course. Course. Our friend Crossman, greatly coarsened with time, you know, said Auden about him to me.
What does coarse mean?
Lack of sensitive, delicate, civilized, opposite of all that. Coarse means crude. It means thick. It means lack of feeling in one's fingertips. Lack of...
all of which made him a successful politician.
Lack of refinement. He wasn't such a success. He wasn't. He wanted to be prime minister. No, he never would get enough people to be loyal to him, ever, to be capable of that. He couldn't help biting every single hand before it fed him, not merely after.
Yeah.
I mean that.
Yeah. What about Harold Wilson as a young Oxford don?
I'll tell you how hard it is. He was at UNIV. He was a lecturer at New College. I used to sit next to him at dinner at New College. He was as dull as a man could be. Thick, sort of, little, sort of, Crossman once said, but Wilson, you're like a little ball bearing. That's what we need. I said to Crossman, who are Wilson's real friends? Crossman said, he thinks I am. Ha, ha, ha. That's what I didn't like.
Yeah.
For example, what is rather awful.
Of course, I'm sad.
Not coarseness, but...
just awful.
The awfulness, yes. Ha, ha. He thinks I am. Ha, ha. He was cynical. He was Wilson, yes. Didn't think I ever thought about him at all. I'm trying to think about Crossman is the subject for it.
Were there any other left-wing intellectuals, figures in the Labour Party with whom
you
did
get... I'll tell you a story about Crossman, this is irrelevant. He went to a Labour Party conference. Bevin wanted something passed, and he thought that Crossman might be an obstacle.
Yes.
So he persuaded him, he got him to himself and said, look, if I do this for you, promise not to do that. Then Crossman agreed to this bargain. Bevin then broke it and did exactly what he promised not to do. So Crossman's thing was defeated. He then approached Crossman, put his arm on his shoulder, and said, no hard feelings, I hope. No hard feelings. You don't mind, do you don't mind too much, don't mind, do you? Dick. That's a great man, said Crossman.
Yeah.
See?
Yeah.
That's my story.
Right. I get the picture.
You get the picture. He betrayed him. He lied. That's the way to do it. And suck up afterwards and not mind talking to you.
Yeah.
Not care what the other man feels at all. No hard feelings. Still. Being still cooperate in the future. Always wanted, I had to do it because I had to win.
Were there any other figures in the party or on the left with whom you had any contact? Lasky, people like that?
Yes. I didn't have contact. I met Lasky once or twice. I couldn't bear him. He was a kind man. He was very nice to colleagues. He was very nice to colleagues. He never read a nasty review in his life. Personally, kindly. Journals. He was a terrible liar. Pathological liar. And he was, I can't help it. I thought he was clever, marvelous lecturer, wonderfully well read. Obviously extraordinarily skillful in some way. So something absolutely indelibly cheap about him.
Really?
Yes. Mm. I couldn't get over. Yes, of course.
Why did you take so strongly against him?
Against
Lasky.
Because I didn't like his sneering tone. I didn't like his sort of sneers. I thought it was too extreme. I thought that he was a pseudo-Marxist. I thought the books were no good. Mm-hmm. They weren't what, the trouble about them was they weren't obscure. They weren't pretentious. Mm-hmm. They weren't what I most liked. But they were superficial to the highest degree. If you wanted to know about the subject, you had an essay by Lasky, you realized it was perfectly empty. I discovered that before I ever met him.
Yeah.
He was in some way jealous of me when we met. Because I'd been praised to him in some way. And he was very competitive, the opposite. And very competitive. He wanted to be top. I didn't know what it was. He was a cheap jerk. It was something totally... he was what's called clever. He was clever, he was quick, he was fast on his feet. And I don't know. I think I like the opposite. I think I like integrity,
yes.
Nobility, extreme clarity of thought, stern sort of clarity and severity of thought, mm-hmm. and some degree of originality and depth, all of which you liked.
Yes.
All of which. And with the result, let me tell you something funny about Lasky. He didn't have a single disciple in England.
Yes.
None. Think of it. Brilliant lecturer. Everybody there is, he worshipped his lectures. Best thing they ever heard. He was very popular, personally, in the Labour Party. English socialists were created by the Webbs, Graham Wallace, Cole, Tawney, above all. Just had exactly one pupil, one real disciple, who's someone at Leeds. I can't do his name. Something like, not Bullifant or Elephant, something like that, some man who writes left-wing books.
Yes.
In India, any number of disciples.
Yes.
In Africa.
Yes.
Some in America.
Some
Israel.
Even in Canada, yes.
Israel.
Yes.
Canada, probably.
Yes.
In England, none.
Yeah. What does that tell you? The further away you are, the better it looked.
Well, the trouble about England, of course, is that all the socialists in England were really clergymen. In some sense, there was a very strong Christian component, even in the Gates School. Not perhaps consciously, but I mean, they were all clergymen, really. I mean, Cole was a tremendous clergyman.
Yeah.
Kingsley Martin was a hedge preacher.
Yes. Tawney, above all.
Very much. He really was a Christian, real Christian.
That was what was attractive about him in
many ways,
it seemed to me.
Yes. Oh, and Sidney Webb could have been a conformist clergyman perfectly easily, you see. But the point was that Lasky was a sort of Weimar Republic man. There was something,
yes.
you see,
yes.
something he danced about.
Yes.
And in the end, the English don't take to that. They enjoy it,
yes.
they read it, but it doesn't rub off. It evaporates.
What was it about his background that led him to behave that way?
Nothing particularly. His father was a Jewish, prosperous Jewish merchant in Manchester, or born in England, or maybe not, but his grandfather came from Poland. His father was a jute merchant or something like that,
yes.
and he and his brother were Manchester Grammar School, afterwards at Oxford.
Yes.
Harold was, I didn't know if Neville, his brother, was. Was he? Nothing in particular, he just was a very clever boy at New College, I think.
Yes.
and was just, exactly what Jews are thought to be, like too clever by half, clever as you make them.
Yeah.
Something I deceive, I'd say. You see?
Yeah.
No, some sort of shortcuts, some sort of corner cutting occurred. And his lies were pathological. This is part of the Walter Mitty business. You see? I mean, he told me stories.
Such as, for instance?
He would say some story you didn't expect to have believed. He said, I was going for a walk the other day near Heinleden, who should I meet? Oh, George. I was in a car, as a matter of fact. He was driving along slowly. I said, hop in. He hopped in. Believe it or not, next man we met was Baldwin. Then we met Lionel McDonald. We had a marvelous talk. Then he reproduced it rather brilliantly. That I don't think he could quite, even he, but he told me the following. When I went to Moscow, I went to the Labour delegation after the war was true. We went to see Stalin. At the end of our talk, when we were leaving, one of the people there said, Professor Lasky, would you mind not leaving your umbrella behind? Because the boss wants to speak to you face to face. So I left my umbrella behind, and I went to call for it, and I took Stalin. We had 2 hours together. It was quite wonderful. And I said to him, you know, your foreign policy isn't quite right. We're really alienating people quite unnecessarily. And he said, you know, you're absolutely right. It's Molotov who makes me do it. I just can't stay. I can't move him. He's so obstinate, there's nothing I can do. I said, you know, we've got exactly the same trouble with Attlee. It's exactly the same. One can't make him move. It's a terrible thing. And then Stalin said, would you like to come to the Politburo? I've got a meeting on it. I said, yes, sure. So I went to the Politburo, and I had 3 hours with him. It was absolutely fascinating. He never was a Stalin alone, ever, at all. He never left. Everything is totally false. I mean, I don't think, pure cock and bull. Because I took somebody with him in that delegation. He never was away from the delegation. Nothing has happened. And couldn't have happened, given Stalin. It's wildly improbable. You see, anyway. But it didn't begin to happen. I mean, some element of truth, they did actually go to see Stalin, yes. That's all. That's the only true bit. Otherwise, nothing. Then, he said to me at Harvard, when I met him, party was given for him by the great Morrison, the historian.
Samuel Eliot.
Sam Morrison, who was great, rather liked him, because he'd been a lecturer at Harvard in the, I don't know what, 1921, and Lowell was very hostile to him, because he was a Jew and a socialist. And Sam Morrison was very snobbish, but he was nevertheless kind of Yankee abolitionist, took up his cause, as he might have a Negro.
Yeah.
And he gave him a party was given for him, to which I went in 49. He then told a story, which was embarrassing, because he said when he was very young, he'd met an old professor, very old professor, whom everyone remembers now, but in the street. And the man said, what are you doing this morning, Lasky? He said, I'm in class. Dismiss your class, come to. I've got something interesting to say. So I went to this man's class, and he said, you know, it's been quite a day in my life. 150 years ago, my brother died. But you can work it out. With very old fathers and half-brothers.
Yeah.
Can just be worked out. You were 70, 80 when you were a child.
Yeah.
Now that story is true about a man in the 1890s in Harvard. If you told it at Yale or at Princeton, it might have been believed.
Yeah.
But at Harvard, it was known to have happened to somebody in the previous century, that story.
Yeah.
So it was very embarrassing when he told it,
and a kind of
having happened to himself. Yes.
Yeah.
But then he said, you know, in that boat I came, Churchill was standing by it. We had quite a talk. He summoned me. I told him he was wrong about this and the other. You know, he admitted he made all the mistakes. They did come by the same boat. Churchill traveled the first class, and Lasky in the second, naturally. And I asked John Martin, who I knew very well, still alive, who was Churchill's private secretary, whether he met Lasky on the journey. Never. He didn't stir from his cabin.
Yeah.
says it's all been a trovato, and it's all Walter Mitty.
It's slightly pathetic, really.
Deeply. Yeah. Yeah. I met C.K. Webster the other day. He said, you know, the Foreign Office, they don't like you. If you really want something important, if you go cap in hand, as I did, they'll do something. Nobody ever went less cap in hand to anybody than my old friend, Professor Charles Kingsley Webster, who was a kind of roundhead type, rude, rough. But Indians were the gibier.
Yes.
They were natural material.
They laughed it up.
Perhaps Nehru. Krishna Menon, thought he was wonderful. Lapped it up at the root. And Americans did. Maurice Barrowman told me he was in a compartment in the train with Lasky and a Rhodes Scholar boy. And he began saying that he'd been to Georgia, in Russia, I mean, and that when you shook off the Chakar man and the NQD man and the Intoris man, they took down the iron and had a marvelous talk with the students. And the American Rhodes Scholar said, Professor Lasky, do you speak Georgian? He said, no. Russian? He looked like a child working with Maurice Barrowman. He said, with my kind of background, it sort of comes. Well, look, this is not about me. This is no sort of nothing to do with me. But anyway, we say, why didn't I like Lasky? For these reasons.
Yes.
I didn't hate him.
Just to round this off, since we've been talking about this kind
Cole,
of...
Cole, I liked very much.
Yeah.
Cole was a schoolboy.
Yeah.
He made bad jokes. He hated bankers. Couldn't be in the room with them.
Yeah.
He was very, you know, said he'd never been happy in his life, except in socialist company. He was very intolerant.
Intolerant?
Yes. He went to my school, and there was something childlike and boyish and disarming about him.
Mm.
He was very vain and very good looking. And when I delivered lectures in Oxford, it was quite well attended. He asked me not to lecture at the same time as him, which I found touching. He didn't want his audience taken away by anyone.
Yes.
So I didn't. I had classes together with him. Him I liked very much. He was a very pure-spirited man, rather silly sometimes. Rather silly and rather naive. Hated Americans. That sort of thing.
Yes.
You see? But... in a kind of left-wing way.
Yeah.
But the one thing which used to infuriate him was American students who wrote him, "Dear Professor Cole, now that Professor Lasky is no more, you are the leading British political hate Lasky."
Yeah.
Tony was quite nice to Lasky.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about Tony, because you worked with Tony in Washington.
Not really, no.
Or you knew him?
No, I didn't. I was in New York. When Tony was in Washington.
He was the labor attaché in Washington.
He was exactly that. He was the first ever. Anyway.
Yes.
It's an invention of Attlee, I think.
Yeah.
I met him. And my job in, what I told you, I think, was that my job in Washington was entirely due to a quarter town attorney with Tony. I told you that story.
Yeah. Yeah.
I never really knew him then.
Yeah.
I met him once, twice. He's extremely nice to me. He read my book on Marx, thought it was quite good and was extremely kind.
Yeah.
Well, Lasky had nothing to say on the subject. I didn't know about Lasky, poor old thing. I mean, I just felt he was ultimately pathetic.
Yeah.
The vanity, the sort of desire to blow himself up.
Yeah.
There was no harm in him.
Yeah.
But I mean, the famous occasion when he was sued for libel. Because somebody had said in some speech he made remarks which were technically subversive of the British Constitution. And therefore he ought to go to jail for that. I mean, he more or less preached revolution. So we wanted, I don't know, enabling acts and so on, that sort of thing, and get rid of the Parliament. Extravagant statements.
Yeah.
And he denied he'd said these things which were technically criminal. And so he sued the man for libel, whoever it said, some journalist, and lost. He had said exactly those things. Nobody was arrested for it, but
yeah.
He said them all right. Then the hat was passed around to enable him to pay for his costs, which was £10,000 in Asia. And I contributed. I was asked to. He died worth about £70,000. It's all roof.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. But he wasn't a bad man.
I wanted to...
He's typical of the extremely shallow nature of socialist ideology in England in the 30s. Marxist ideology. Because he saw himself as a Marxist.
Yeah.
Well, Marxism in England in the 30s was a very thin affair.
Yeah.
I've never known Dasky convert anyone to anything. That's what I mean. Something we didn't get seized. John Strachey converted more people to Marxism than anybody.
Yes. Strachey was much more. The coming world crisis or whatever it was called.
The world.
The coming crisis of capitalism.
Coming crisis.
Of capitalism.
That's right.
Yeah. Yes. That book exerted a large influence on my father, I remember.
Well, it is a very powerful work.
Yeah. What, you went to Harvard
you
first?
You followed Toynbee in the end.
Yes.
Head of a system.
Yes. Poor man. You went to Harvard first in 49, and then again in the early 50s.
Yes, 51 and 53.
To lecture for a term at a time.
Yeah. And then in 62, I think. Cuba number 2 was then, wasn't it?
The
missile crisis, but I remember. That's when I was at Harvard.
You were in Harvard during the
then. That was what, 60?
Two.
And then I wasn't lecturing, I was at some kind of research. Forward research, something like that.
Right.
George Kennan is a man who recommended me to Harvard.
Originally. Mm. Because you'd known him in the Moscow.
Quite so.
What kind of impression did Kennan make on you? Complicated character.
Very. I met him in Moscow, and he was a man of great charm. And genuinely a distinguished personality. He took great interest in Russia. He read Pushkin and Dostoevsky and Tolstoy, above all Chekhov, of whom he wanted to write, and whom he wanted to write a book.
And his father had written this great book
his
about
uncle.
The penal settlements.
Uncle.
His uncle, sorry.
A famous book called Russia and the Penal, Russia and the something like penal system or something.
Yes.
Written a book denouncing.
Yes.
What happened was that he went to Russia and he was very strongly pro-Tsarist, the uncle. And then he became anti, because they wrote articles in favor.
Yes.
So they gave him every facility.
Yes.
Came back and written denunciation.
Yes.
All this whole thing happens with Israel nowadays. And all these unfortunate, he met a lot of liberals sitting in chains in Siberia, imagine. Was asked why they went, because they were in favor of proportional representation, which they were torturing.
Yeah,
ridiculous. All that. Was he? All right. He was his nephew, and a great uncle or uncle. Came from Indiana, South Bend, I think. He was talked to me at great length about Russia, its character, and was very good in Russian politics at that time. His hatred of Stalinism was absolutely obsessive. Then, all that changed later. And I enjoyed talking to him very much. He was highly intelligent, and we used to discuss these things. We got on extremely well. He was a genuinely intellectually interested American diplomat.
And they are
unusual.
Few and far between.
But my great friend Chip Berlin, to whom I was devoted, wasn't that.
Yeah.
He studied, but took the volume of Lenin to bed with him every night, but that's different. He's like a sort of East German Junker watching the animal. Every specific tremor in his body, he wanted to interpret.
Yeah.
Berlin.
Yeah.
But Kennan took another what might be called sort of rather more till Jessica Lange.
Yeah.
General propositions.
Okay.
And on the whole, understood what was happening rather less in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
So, then after that, I saw him in Washington, I suppose. I came back. No, I don't think I did. I came back in 1946. He was still in Moscow, I think. But I met him in Washington when I came back in 1949, when he was... Who was president in 1949?
Truman.
Truman. I think he was then in the State Department, head of some policy planning thing.
Yeah.
That's when we did his wife.
He was writing The Containment.
That's when Mr. X.
Mr. X came back.
Which I entirely went along with. I thought it was very good, quite right. He had then met his Norwegian wife, Annalisa. Then he came to Oxford. As some sort of, wait, when he was then sacked by Dulles. He went to Berlin and gave an interview at the airport, which he said that Stalin was worse than Hitler. That was enough, not to make a persona grata.
Yeah.
He couldn't get back.
Mm-hmm.
And then Dulles sacked him and put him into some charge, some minor thing.
Mm-hmm.
Then he went to Princeton. Then I saw him there, and the problem when I went to visit, in 1951, and then in Oxford when he came as professor of something, he came to Oxford or something. Three times he came to Oxford.
Mm-hmm.
Then he talked to me. But then he became ambassador to Yugoslavia, and they obviously were extremely affable to him. And that's when you return on polycentrism. Then the Soviet Union began to cultivate him in a very intensive way.
Yeah. Mm.
And then he gradually turned.
Yeah.
He's a man of colossal vanity.
Yeah.
Colossal.
Mm.
I remember when the Afghanistan was invaded, I was at Princeton. He said, he left Princeton for 3 days in case journalists wanted to do his views. Nobody asked him, in fact. He then said this in the end. The 12th hour, we're done for, was long destroyed. There's no way of saving this country. The atom bomb, this way, that way, talking in an apocalyptic manner. The guests at dinner were hideously embarrassed. He saw himself as a world spiritual force, on a par with Gandhi, Mother Teresa,
oh God.
Nehru,
was it as bad as that?
Yes.
Really?
Above parties. He was asked if he'd like to be sent to the Senate, I think, in West Virginia, which I think we have to follow.
Mm-hmm.
He said only provided both parties nominated him. He saw himself as Woodfield Lamele, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Great spiritual force.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes. No, he's got mystical conviction about himself. Very nice man.
Yeah,
same time, kind, generous, intelligent, and very good writer.
Mm.
Oh, I'll tell you a story about him. It has nothing to do with me. Well, that's just right. He was delivering lectures in Oxford of a book which afterwards became the story of American intervention in Russia.
Yeah.
Very good lecture they were, and
yeah.
Book was excellent. Beautifully delivered. So, in the middle, he suddenly said, next week, it's the 7th of November, anniversary of the great Russian Revolution. I will interrupt these lectures and have a general talk about the Soviet Union. Enormous audience. Came in looking pale, handsome, beautiful voice. Went up to the platform of the lectern and said, Russia is a very great country, great nation. They are marvelously gifted. They have produced some of the world's greatest masterpieces. They have, as human beings, among the best people, the most gifted, the most interesting, the most distinguished the world has ever known. But what they seek is power. The people in the Kremlin sit thinking intensively about any one thing, and that is how to acquire world power. And because they're able and fanatical and think about nothing else, they will have it. And we go pursuing pleasure, the arts, and we will give in. There's no doubt about it. They will destroy us. It was like a Pétainist speech in France in 1940 saying, yeah, we are right, yeah, and we've got a whoring after pleasures and the yeah, Nazis yeah, or something, and we're no good, we're corrupt. Yeah. You see, this went on, this awful stuff. And then he said, the Russian great nation, but even they haven't solved every problem. They've never solved the problem of death. Shiver ran through the audience. He then went on and he said, in 1917, a man called Lenin came in a train to Russia during the revolution. Lloyd, that was a fatal moment. Lloyd George, who was Prime Minister of Great Britain, should have gone to Paris. He should have said to Clemenceau, Lenin has gone to Russia. He will destroy everything we believe. We must stop the war. Kerensky cannot do it. The Russians are in disarray. They're being defeated by the Germans. For God's sake, get them out of the war. If you don't, Lenin will win. And then the situation, from our point of view, will be far worse. What at worst could happen? The Kaiser will win this war against us. That would matter far less than Lenin. You can imagine, can you not? Lord George taking the
yes, boat. It's such a plausible scenario.
Saying, Mr. Clemenceau, Michael Lenin, you never heard of him? Well, he's in Russia, I can tell you that.
And, it's big
and if
trouble.
He gets it, if Kerensky doesn't stop, we're in trouble. I mean, the Kaiser's bad enough, but nothing. He said it. You see? So there is a touch. Something is screwed loose somewhere. Yeah. I talked to him afterwards. I said, look, George, you don't really mean that. Lord George could have said this to Clemenceau. He looked a little pensive. He said, no, maybe not. I suppose I went a bit far. I said, I think a bit. But still, you know. He then talked about Lenin exactly as Churchill was talking about him.
As a demonic figure.
The worst, yes. Destroyer of the world. So, more complicated picture of Kellen will get from his autobiography.
Indeed.